warrantless surveillance. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Capitol Hill, approved a $95 billion foreign aid package for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. The House also approved a bill that could lead to a ban on the social media app TikTok. Speaker Mike Johnson pushed the bills forward despite growing Republican calls for him to resign, in part over support for supporting $61 billion in aid to Ukraine. The bill passed by a vote of 112. Every Democrat who voted supported the measure. The $26 billion Israel aid bill passed 366 to 58. 37 Democrats and 21 Republicans opposed the bill. Opponents of the bill included Texas Democratic Congressmember Joaquin.
All of us have seen the of Gaza. We have seen how Prime Minister Netanyahu's government has used American weapons to force famine. Over 25,000 women and children dead, tens of thousands of missiles and bombs levied on innocent civilians. We cannot escape what we see before us every day. Are we going to participate in that carnage or not? I choose not to.
In Gaza, Palestinian civil defense workers have found at least 210 bodies buried in a mass grave in the courtyard of the Nasser complex in the southern Gaza city Yunis. The discovery comes 2 weeks after Israeli forces withdrew from the hospital. Al Jazeera reports many of the bodies found included women. Some reportedly had their hands tied behind their backs. Palestinians have been searching the hospital grounds for bodies of loved ones killed during the Israeli siege.
It is a difficult scene. Beyond what you can imagine. It is a disarming the body of a dear human being.
The official death toll in Gaza has topped 34,000, including more than 14,000 children. Over Rafah, at least 22 people, including 18 children. One of the strikes killed a Palestinian man, his wife, who was 30 weeks pregnant, and their four-year-old daughter. Doctors at Dubai Hospital performed an emergency cesarean section on the dead mother and delivered her child. Dr. Mohammed Salama is the head of the neonatal intensive care unit at the Emirati Hospital in Rafah.
The baby girl came out in a tragic situation. She came out and found herself an orphan directly. Came into life without care. As soon as she came, she had a moderate to severe respiratory distress. The name that came out was Baby of a Martyr. And this in itself, a hard word, a tragic word. Even as we write this label, our hands tremble. The thing is hard.
In the occupied West Bank, Palestinians staged a general strike Sunday after Israeli forces killed at least 14 Palestinians during a 50-hour siege on the Nur Shams refugee camp in the city of Tulkarm. Residents of Nur Shams said the Israeli raid left the camp uninhabitable.
Seeing it is not like hearing about it. You can see with your eyes what happened. Destruction. Gaza number two. What happened is that they left nor people, nor stones. It's uninhabitable by humans. What happened is destruction. Destruction. They turned the camp into something uninhabitable. It is terrible.
In a separate incident, the Palestinian Red Crescent Society reports Israeli settlers shot dead a Palestinian ambulance driver south of Nablus as he was trying to reach Palestinian raid settlers. Mohammed Awad Alamusa was a 50-year-old volunteer paramedic with the Palestine Red Crescent. This comes as the Biden administration preparing to issue sanctions on Netzah Yehuda Battalion, an ultra-Orthodox Israeli military unit accused of committing human rights abuses against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. In other news, Israel's chief of military intelligence has resigned. Major General Aharon Haliva is the first senior Israeli official to resign over Hamas's October 10th attack on Israel. In his resignation letter, Haliva wrote, quote, "The intelligence directorate under my command did not live up to the task we were entrusted with." He also called for a state commission to investigate intelligence failures prior to October 7th. Israeli opposition leader Yair Lapid praised Haliva's decision to resign and called on Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to follow suit. Columbia University has canceled in-person classes today as campus protests over the war on Gaza enter a sixth day. Classes will be held online today as the campus remains largely locked down. The protests have swelled after the arrest last week of over students who'd set up a call for the school to divest from Israel. Organizers say at least 50 students have been suspended from Barnard and 35 from Columbia. Columbia and Barnard alum employees and guest speakers have also publicly condemned or announced they're boycotting the prestigious institutions. Meanwhile, Gaza solidarity protests and encampments have begun on campuses across the country, including at Yale, MIT, Tufts, NYU, the New School, and the University of Carolina, Chapel Hill. Officials at USC, that's the University of Southern California, have canceled all outside speakers, including John, the director of Crazy Rich Asians, and tennis legend Billie Jean King. The decision comes days after the school sparked outrage by canceling a speech the valedictorian Asna Tabassum over what the school claimed were safety reasons. Tabassum is a first-generation South Asian-American Muslim who'd expressed support. President Biden has signed legislation to reauthorize Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, despite warnings from privacy experts that the bill could greatly expand the ability for the government to conduct warrantless domestic surveillance. The Senate approved the FISA bill Friday in a 60-34 vote. Critics include Democratic Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon, who described the bill as, quote, one of the most dramatic and terrifying expansions of government surveillance authority in history.
If you have access to any communications, the government can force you to help it spy. That means anybody with access to a server, a wire, a cable box, a Wi-Fi router, a phone, or a computer. If this provision is enacted, the government can deputize any of these people against their will and force them, in effect, to become what amounts for Big Brother.
Opening arguments begin today in Donald Trump's criminal trial. He's the first former president to ever be criminally charged. He faces 34 felony counts of falsifying business records to hide $130,000 paid to adult film star Stormy Daniels to impact the 2006. Jurors and six alternates have been sworn in. On Friday, a man set himself on fire in a park outside the Manhattan criminal courthouse where Trump is being tried. Azarello, friends of the man, said he'd become consumed with conspiracy theories in recent years. In Ecuador, voters overwhelmingly supported a referendum approving President Daniel Noboa's security plan for tackling gang-related crime. The new measures include expanding military and police authority, tightening gun control fences, and imposing stricter penalties for crimes considered to be acts of terrorism. The Sunday vote came as a prison warden in the western state of Manabí was shot dead. Tudy of Portobello was killed, the third Ecuadorian mayor to be assassinated in less than a month. President Noboa declared an internal armed conflict in January. Some rights groups warn Noboa's crackdown will lead to more abuses by officials. The spiraling security crisis and severe drought conditions have forced tens of thousands of Ecuadorians to flee towards the U.S.-Mexico border. The U.S. military has announced it will withdraw troops from Niger and close down a major drone base that it built 6 years ago. On Sunday, hundreds of protesters in Niger marched in Agadez to demand it withdraw. Russia strengthens ties with the U.S.-trained military junta in Niger, which seized power last year in a coup. In labor news, Volkswagen employees in a Tennessee factory have overwhelmingly voted to join the United Auto Workers Union. The plant will become the first foreign-owned factory in the South to unionize. It comes in the wake of the historic strike and contract gains with the U.S. auto industry's big three companies last year. The UAW has pledged to unionize auto workers across. UAW President Sean Fain spoke at a conference organized by Labor Notes.
4,000 workers in Chattanooga, Tennessee, did what many people said was impossible. You know, we did what the pundits said couldn't be done. Every time I was interviewed by people, when we talked about organizing the South, they would always, do you really think you can win the South? And you know what? Those workers stood up for themselves. That's how we won, and they voted for a union.
Biden administration's updated Title IX rules codifying the rights of transgender students and undoing some of the Trump-era rollbacks of the landmark rights law. The new rules expand sex discrimination and harassment to include LGBTQ discrimination as Republicans around the country escalate attacks on transgender children. The new rules also increase protections for pregnant people and survivors of sexual assault in schools. In California, three officers have been charged with involuntary manslaughter in the 2021 police killing of Mario Gonzalez. The Alameda County District Attorney reopened the case against Eric McKinley, James Fisher, and Cameron Leahy after the preceding DA closed it in 2022. 26-year-old Mario Gonzalez was alone in a park when the officer did him kneeling on his body until he became unresponsive. Gonzalez left behind a young son. In China, at least three people have died, evacuated another 60 people from their homes as massive floods have inundated parts of Guangdong province after record-breaking rains. And here in the United States, President Biden's announced Solar Energy Day speech at Virginia's Prince William Forest today. The Biden campaign is hoping to capitalize on young voter support for climate clarity dwindles amid ongoing war on Gaza. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In New York, university has canceled in-person classes today as campus protests over Israel's war on Gaza enter a sixth day. Online today. The protests have swelled after the arrest last week of over 100 students who'd set up an encampment to call for the school to divest from Israel. Organizers say at least students have been suspended from 30 from Columbia. A growing number of Columbia and Barnard alumni, employees, and guest speakers have also publicly condemned or announced their boycott the prestigious institution. Protests and encampments also began on other college campuses here in New York City, at NYU, at the New School, as well as across the country, including at Yale, MIT, Tufts, Vanderbilt, and University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. We're joined right now by two guests. In a moment, we'll speak with Columbia University Professor Mahmoud Mamdani, who addressed students participating in the Gaza Solidarity encampment on Columbia's campus multiple times last week. But we begin with Jude Taha, Danian journalist, journalism student at Columbia University Journalism School. She's on Columbia's campus here in New York, where the student-led Gaza Solidarity encampment is still. She's joining us from her school at Columbia Journalism School right now. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jude. Can you lay out what's happened over the weekend? What are people's demands? And the fact that today, the president, who all this happened a day after she testified before Congress, has shut down the universities all online today.
Thank you for having me. Right now, what we're seeing at Columbia is an unprecedented act of solidarity set up. We initially set it up on the South Lawn and then were faced violent arrests and a lot of repression from administration and ended up moving to Sing Lawn. What we're seeing right now is just swaths of people initially without tents, sleeping on the ground in sleeping bags, some of them without sleeping bags, on grass outside in the cold under the rain. And what we're seeing is just they have three solid demands. The first is divestment. The second is for Columbia to disclose their financial and their financial records, especially in relation to their workings with Israel. And the third is amnesty towards students. The students have been very clear in the fact that they are not moving, that they are very set in their demands. Some negotiations are happening from what I've heard from organizers at the encampment. However, nothing has been announced yet. I know there are a few things that came up yesterday that were a bit surprising, which was the repitching of the tents. Organizers have said the administration is aware of the tents. However, that does not necessarily mean that they agree. Organizers held a town hall last night where they emphasize, obviously, with an act of protest as large as this, to take over the space in the lawn comes a level of risk. And they are very comfortable in where there's a community being built. And they are very clear in their demands. They have three top demands, first and furthermost with Smith.
So, Jude, if you can talk about the whole progression of what happened from Shafiq, President Shafiq testifying before to these, I won't say unprecedented arrests. Over 100 students were arrested, but since, I think, 1960 or more.
I think what had happened initially was students showed up at the lawn at around 4:30 a.m. They are members of a called Columbia University Apartheid Divest, which is made up of many student groups. And they had been planning this for months, according to my interviews with organizers. They studied the 1968 protests. They studied the tactics used, and they were prepared to go. Initially, we did not know this as outsiders. The tents were set up and a lot of people were caught off guard. But this has been something that the organizers have planned for, especially in relation to Manoush Shafiq's hearing. But what happened is after they set up tents, we quickly saw an outpour of support. Picket lines were forming. Students were joining from outside. And initially what I saw to be like 40 to 50 students is now on the opposite lawn, nearly 100, 200 students coming in and out of the encampment. The arrests were shocking. However, what was truly inspiring, not let that deter them. Shortly after the arrests were carried out and after protests were surrounding the lawn where the original encampment was at, students starting jumping lawn and pitching up tents there. And this is a reaction not only to Columbia's silencing of students and the fact that students feel unheard, uncared for, and not represented well by the incident, but this is also very much so focused towards the ongoing genocide in Gaza and the way they students are feeling. The massacres happen every day with nearly over 30,000 people have been killed. Their frustration is that they are complicit in this and their university is complicit in this, and they want to make sure that their voices are heard, and they want to make sure that when what they're asking is met. And so this is inspired by the 1968 protests. They decided to follow course.
So something unusual was tweeted on Friday. You're speaking to us from the Columbia J School, from the Columbia Journalism School. Yes. I had just been at the after the encampment on Thursday night. To say the least, it was not easy for anyone to get in who did not have a student ID. Even that won't get you in right now. It was a true lockdown. And the next morning at about 10 o'clock, where you are, the Columbia J School, tweeted, Columbia Journalism School is committed to a free press. If you're a credentialed member of the media and have been denied access to campus, please send us a DM. We will facilitate access to campus. Is this a direct rebuke of the president, of President Shafiq?
I cannot speak to that. I do know that our dean, Jelani Cobb, is very committed to freedom of press. And I know that Dean Cobb has been incredibly supportive of the students who have been reporting on this and is very interested in ensuring that information transferred clearly and accurately. Whether it is a direct rebuke, that is unfortunately not something I am aware of. However, I will say since then, it has been increasingly challenging. I am not sure of the dynamics of the journalism school. I have been speaking with multiple journalists who are in to cover the encampment, and increasingly it's been harder and harder to try and get them in. There's not been really any clear guidelines that I can share about what does that entail for the journalists. The thing is, people are believing that the facilitation through the journalism school means access to the encampment. And I would like to emphasize the encampment is not facilitating with the journalism school. It is an entity that it's functioning on its own. And it is a living space as much as it is, you know, a private space within the university. Vulnerable there. They're also very hesitant to speak to media. While they do believe that the media presence is important, there has been this notion of belief that the journalism is facilitating access into the encampment, which is not true. The journalism school was helping facilitate entrance into campus for credentialed press.
And if you also can talk about the what the police chief said in response to the Columbia president. New York Police Chief John Shell, President Shafiq identified the demonstration as a clear and present danger, but that officers found the students to be peaceful and cooperative. Shafiq, all students participating in the encampment would be suspended. And level of suspensions, Jude, if you can talk about that, both at Columbia and even more at Barnard, and what exactly this locked out of their rooms almost immediately and lose their meal cards in addition to everything else?
To be quite honest, me and a few other journalists have been reporting on this for months now. We are familiar with students. We are familiar with these demands, and we were present from day one, from nearly 6 a.m. in the original encampment, and there was violence that I am able to report. The protesters were incredibly peaceful. Their demands are largely focused on divestment, and they have community guidelines that they are asking to abide by. And the community guidelines are to ensure safety, are to ensure that everyone feels comfortable in the space, and to ensure that Gaza is being centered first. In relation to what the police chief said, I have to agree that I was not able to identify any violence or any danger that is present from these students, especially right now in the second encampment community. Food, blankets, students are leaving their belongings, their personal belongings, for hours with no worry that they will be taken. There is no fear amongst them. Therefore, it is truly an intimidation tactic, and the response that we have seen from President Manoush Shafiq has been incredibly disheartening towards students. Students have been evicted. A organizer that I've spoken to yesterday is terrified. They are not comfortable walking out alone. They had to leave the state. 15 minutes to access, they are being suspended with waiting for a appeal or waiting for a meeting with administration to understand the grounds of the suspension or what that entails. Leaving students in limbo, feel supported, they do not know where they're going. And it is incredibly disheartening and terrifying for some are 18, 19-year-olds to be their campus. And another thing is that the organizers have made it clear that this is an intimidation tactic by the administration. And especially in Shafiq's email that was sent at 1 a.m. last night, the organizers have stated that this is an intimidation tactic to try and scare people who are in the encampment out of all the demands of the movement. But a lot of students are learning these risks, and they're banding together and they're standing together to demand. It is unclear why this is happening or the levels of suspension. Students who have been suspended but have not been evicted are concerned about to lose access to their housing, and students who have lost access to their housing were not given any clear instructions, as far as I know, for where to go next. So it is just this great limbo for the movement and for the demands that they are asking for, but they are not being met with any support from an administration or guidance. And it is unclear what President Shafiq is citing when she says danger. And therefore, that is leaving a lot of organizers confused as to what is actually happening.
And among those arrested was Congressmember Ilhan Omar's daughter, Isra Hirsi, both suspended and arrested. And finally, very quickly, before we go to Professor Mamdani, the day school speaker for 15th, and this is a long time away, so we'll see what happens, is the Haaretz Israeli reporter Amira Haas, deeply critical of the occupation. Gaza, lived in Gaza, the only Israeli Jewish journalist to have lived there for years. Is that right?
Yep, that is correct. As far as we know, that has not been changed. The speaker has been chosen for quite a long time now. And as far as I know, that has not been changed.
Well, Jude Taha, I want to thank you for being with us. We're also joined by Mahmoud Mamdani. Mahmoud Mamdani is a Columbia University professor who addressed students participating in the Gaza Solidarity Encampment on the South Lawn in Columbia campus, professor of government, and the number of books, including Neither Settler Nor Native, The Making and Unmaking of Permanent Minorities. Professor Mamdani, welcome back to Democracy Now! If you can just respond to what's happened, describe the scene as you gave your address to the students. You've spoken several times at the encampment.
I was asked by a divest committee to give a talk on the historical origins of the divesting, particularly in South Africa. And I gave a talk which basically outlined that divestment was a response to settler colonialism. And I explained to them how you identify settler colonialism as a regime which has different sets of rules and laws for different groups of people in the same society. And secondly, the point of these different rules and laws regulate unequal access to public resources, all the way from residence to occupation to public health, education, and so on. And finally, that this state, which enforces this unequal treatment, institutionalized, legally enforce unequal treatment of different groups, this state, its sovereignty is under the group. So that's the talk that I gave. Then the next day, I was invited back to talk again because we had organized a faculty panel on anti-Semitism. And the point of this panel was to consider the report, the first report of the anti-Semitism task force set up by the university. There were five of us on the panel, and I was invited to talk about and did. I told them that we went through this report, we combed through this report, because there had been, prior to the issue of the report, there had been a faculty discussion, what is anti-Semitism? And the co-chair of the panel had sort of said that, no, we don't have a definition of anti-Semitism, but we know it when we hear it or when we see it. She was using a judge's response to a question decades ago on what you understand by pornography. But the problem was that this particular panel was supposed to